Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Hellbender Books Show on the BookSpeak Network. I'm Lawrence Knorr, and tonight I have the distinct pleasure to interview Keith Rummel, who is joining us from somewhere in Florida. We'll find out. Keith is an author and screenwriter known for his Thanatology series, a number of other supernatural thrillers that he's written, and then the Culture Collide series, of which Southside Sinners, his upcoming release, is one of them. Keith, have you joined us?
I have. How are you?
Good. Great. How are things in Florida?
Things in Florida are really nice. We're having a little bit of a cool wave. It's about 73 degrees here, so it's during the day, so it's real nice. Right now it's in the upper 50s, so it's beautiful.
Oh, that's nice.
Very nice.
You have some relations probably up in the Northeast too. Just went through that nor'easter.
Yeah,
any news
I've been
on that?
Hearing about that.
Yeah.
Just people are cold, and some people who are without power, unfortunately, and hopefully they get that rectified real soon. So, have a lot of friends and family up north. So, just hope everybody's okay.
Here at the Christian Baker Farm, we just had some wind and some branches down and such. Power went out for a few minutes, but otherwise we're good to go. And all that's moved on, so we're definitely not going to have an interruption, knock on wood, to our show tonight. So,
excellent.
Keith, you got your start with the Thanatology series. The Curse Man was your first book. I think it's been almost 7 years since we first saw it. What exactly does Thanatology mean?
Well, Thanatology is the study of death and dying and the principles associated with it. And it's not too... The series is not named Thanatology to be over-the-top morbid, but it has a theme, and the theme has to do with, obviously, death and dying and the studies associated with it. So it's what people are going through maybe in life or maybe in the afterlife, and you meet supernatural creatures along the way or supernatural beings, and everybody plays a pivotal role, and it's not, I wouldn't consider it to be, so I actually consider it to be a thriller or a suspense or a psycho thriller, much in the vein of Sixth Sense, I just think, or Jacob's Ladder, something like that, really good. So it's a mind blender, mind beater, and I like to really put my heart and soul into the stories, and tell a story that's really compelling, original, and I really strive for that, and I strive to really challenge the reader's imagination. So that's the basis of the Thanatology series.
Well, they must be pretty good, because the first two, The Cursed Man and The Lurking Man, actually might be the first three, have either been shot as movies or you have an arrangement to do so. So
yes.
Maybe talk a little bit about The Cursed Man and then The Lurking Man and what's happened with them.
Okay, absolutely. The Cursed Man is the first one in the series, and it was picked up, I would say, about 4 years ago by a production company in California, and the producer and my co-writer, Jim Perry, we took a very complex story. The Cursed Man is a very complex story, and we cut it down into a 90-minute film, and it ran and is continuing to run through the festival circuit right now. So it is still doing the festival circuit, so we're not quite yet near release of distribution. meaning which channels it's going to go to, meaning the screen, or if it's going to go on to Hulu, Netflix, something else like that. We're not really sure, so I can't really speculate on that because nothing's been decided. It does star Bram Gallagher, who made a brief appearance in the Game of Thrones. He was he also did a show in Ireland called Striking Out, very popular. You also have Jim Tovar, who was in Harry Potter. You have Ruth Connell, who was in WB Supernatural in it. You also have the wonderful Maritza Bricasac, who's been in so many different things. I can't even begin to name them all. Soap operas and lots of movies and lots of shorts and things like that. And the movie had won, at this point, 20 Festival of Award wins and 5 nominations, which is real nice. So it's off to a really good start.
Tell us a little bit about the story, though. I mean, give us a little bit about the story of The Cursed Man.
Sure, sure. I don't want to give too many spoilers. So the main character's name is Alistair, and Alistair believes that death is in love with him, and he believes that anybody that talks to him dies within 24 hours. So he's inside this mental institution, and a doctor comes to see him, and of course, you know, I had to make the doctor a young, beautiful woman, and, you know, that's very aggressive in the way that she wants to treat people and help them. And when she speaks and makes contact with Alistair, and she's met with resistance to actually meet with Alistair from the hospital staff, she does eventually get to meet Alistair, and Alistair now is waiting for death to reawaken and strike because he has had a 20-year silence. He's been living in silence for 20 years, and that's where the story takes place. So
I guess the teaser is everybody who comes in contact with him dies within a short period of time.
Yes, it's a 24-hour period, and having known that or having speculated that from his past, which is unveiled through the book, is that, like you said, people die within the 24 hours. So here you are in the present day, and here this doctor comes in after not heeding the warnings of, you know, the hospital staff that's aghast that even somebody wants to come and see him because they've locked him away. He's cared for in the sense that he's fed and he's clothed, but he's in isolation, and he's in isolation in his mind and in the minds of the hospital staff to protect everybody. And when this doctor comes to pay him a visit, he believes that the curse has reawoken, and you are then brought through his current predicament of now having to face that potentially the curse is reawoken. And he braces himself, and he's waiting for the killings to begin again.
Yeah. Well, having read it several times, it's pretty intense. I certainly vouch for that. Let's talk about the Lurking Man now. Is that actually a sequel to The Cursed Man, or how does that work?
It is a sequel. So we have 4 books in the series. We have The Cursed Man, Book 1. Book 2 is The Lurking Man. Book 3 is The Sinful Man. Book 4 is The Silent Woman. But the unique thing about the series is the first 3 books can be read in any order. I always tell people that once you start getting into The Silent Woman, it should be read as the 4th, although it could be a standalone. But for it to be richer, because it does tag onto the characters that appear in Book 1, 2, and 3, it makes for a better story if The Silent Woman is read as Book 4. So the first 3 can be read in any order. It is a series, and it's obviously with the Thanatology theme running through it. It's quite different approaches each book, and they're very unique in the sense of what I do with them. And The Lurking Man is about a woman that wakes up underneath a spotlight, and she's surrounded by darkness. And she doesn't know where she is or how she got there, but she knows well enough not to touch the darkness, because the darkness is, in some ways, I would say, not pleasant to her. And it just doesn't require her touch. And if it's repelling her, it's keeping her in the light. And then she finds herself surrounded by death. and then the story throttles forward. It goes back and forth in time, as all the Thanatology books do. They go from past to present, so that way you can see what they did to get where they are, and then ultimately get the resolve at the end of the book. There's a supernatural creature that I have fallen absolutely in love with, Sariel, played by Dan
Hopefully
Lynch.
Not literally.
No, not literally, but I really do like this character a lot. I think he's really something special, and I think that he has so much more to offer than just one book, and that's, you know, as you know, we're going to also release it in the future, the Book of Sariel. Character is fantastic, and I think that the two characters, Sariel and Kalian, the woman underneath the light, they just play off each other so well. And like I had begun to mention before in the movie, Dan Lynch is playing Sariel and Maritza Brickasack is playing Kalian. And they have both won multitude of awards for best actor, best actress for their performance. I mean, this is such a powerful story, and it sends such a powerful message that I think readers can really, you know, latch onto it, because it's much more than, you know, a woman just being surrounded by death. This has so much depth, and it's actually based off of a true story, as all the Thanatology books are. But this one's very close to my heart because it's based off of somebody very close to me. So I really love that story.
So the movie's been filmed. Where's that at in the process?
Well, we are approaching distribution decisions very soon. So I should have an announcement, and certainly within probably April or the latest May 2018 here. So we are really, it's run its festival course. We're pretty much done. And I'm very humbled to say that the movie is taken in 94 wins at the festivals and 48 nominations. So it's taken in a real lot. I mean, it's a real powerful, powerful movie, very powerful story, very moving, translated very well from the novel to the film. My co-writer and also one of the stars of the movie, Maritza Brickasack, she helped get it film ready. And an interesting tidbit, when somebody reads the book, how powerful Sariel is. He was originally thought to be just a voiceover in the movie. They weren't going to actually put him on the screen. But Daniel Lynch had done such a good job that Maritza, the executive producer and the lead actress, just was absolutely compelled to put him on the screen. So very moving film.
I would say, you know, it's been my opinion since I've seen it, at least the preview, that Dan has helped create, along with your vision, a character I've equated to Pinhead from the Hellraiser series, someone who's as striking and just profoundly sort of charismatic, but in a dark way, just is very, compelling. And you just... You're just very interested in that character. He certainly nailed it. And I think your idea of a Book of Sariel is a great idea to continue that character.
Yeah. And it's like people look at death and it's you know, because I'm actually intrigued by it. And that's where my curiosity of these things come in. Obviously, we write about it a lot of times. We write about things that we're interested in, things that move us or what have you. And Sariel was something that I had created after The Cursed Man, and we had decided that this was going to be a series, you know, with Sunbury Press and now Hellbender Books. I just felt that this character was so strong, and his personality is far beyond just this thing that is taking people from life. He's so much deeper than that, and he's such a deep character. He's really likable, and you could actually feel pity for the character. And I don't want to spoil why you could feel pity for the character, and you know why, because obviously you've read the book and you've seen the movie and stuff. But the character is very, very multidimensional, so he's really cool, and he needs to be carried on. Absolutely.
Definitely, and highly recommend it. So the Sinful Man, the third book, maybe give us a little bit on that and where you're at with that as well.
The Sinful Man, like I said, all of these Thanatology books are based off of true stories. So this one is actually based off of two true stories. It's based off of something that happened in Florida here. I don't want to ruin what it is because it's actually one of the – actually both events are major movers of the story. But it's about a character named Leo, and Leo finds himself running through a very dense and thick forest with just things chasing him. And he doesn't know how he got there, what's chasing him, but it's chasing him, and it's not just one thing, it's many things. And it chases him into a cabin. And this is where we meet Twyla, and Twyla is the keeper of the cabin. And it ties very much into the Thanatology series. It ties very much into The Lurking Man. And it's just really interesting because, not to get preachy on people, but the idea came from the biblical passage, as I walk through the valley of shadow of death, I should fear no evil, for thou art with me. And I just said to myself, with these two true events that happened, I said, well, what happens if you could do something so bad in life that God is not with you and you were in the valley of death? What would happen to you? What would it be like? And that's what this is. And this isn't just all dark and gloomy. This is actually there's a reviewer said that there's really a very strong moral lesson in this story. It's a very strong moral lesson. And you find out what that is and the reason why he's in this cabin, why he came across this cabin. It's really, again, I try to be fresh and unique, and I really think that, you know, we're our own worst critics when it comes to writers, and we're not really sure if our work is good enough. And, you know, as you know, I'm always asking the editor, Jen, I'm like, is this good? Is this good? Is this good? You know, because it needs to be of quality to me, because we can't be really, most time, we can't be a good judge of our own work. And I just feel that it's a real strong story, and it sends a real sensible and very powerful message. And that will be hopefully coming to film soon. It is possibly being done by the same people that did The Lurking Man. So that's Maritza and team, and we'll see what happens. So it hasn't been filmed yet, but there are plans to start filming this year.
Very good. The Silent Woman has been out a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that really is the fourth book, although the other three can be read in any order.
Tell us
a little bit about The Silent Woman.
Oh, The Silent Woman. The Silent Woman is... This is really like... I would really call this like a second half, but not a direct connection to, although again, it makes a richer story. It's very much like The Cursed Man in a lot of aspects. You don't know what's going on. And in fact, the book had been delayed for reasons that we won't get into here. It had been delayed, and I hadn't picked up the book in a long time. And when I was picking it up and preparing it to go to the editor, I didn't even really remember the full plot, and I'll tell you, I was just like, where in the world am I going with this? And when I finally understood what I was doing, because we, generally speaking, we don't read our works once it's done. So it just goes, and it, you know, gets released, and then we move on, and we're writing the next one. But this one I revisited, and when I revisited it, I was just like, wow, this is actually really cool, and this is really a full-on psychological thriller. And again, it's based off of a true story, and it's this one revolves around a woman that has taken a vow of silence. And, you know, much like The Cursed Man, where he had taken a vow of silence, Alistair in the room, because he believed that death was in love with him, her vow of silence is for a much different reason. And the reason is somewhat sinister, but I don't want to reveal exactly what that is because that's the twist of the story. But The Silent Woman is again, it's a nice psychological thriller. It's going to beat your brains up a little bit and You know, just when you think you know what's going on, here comes another twist. And that's one thing that I try to keep through the series, is I try to keep it very unpredictable. I try to keep it entertaining. And like I said, I think uniqueness is important to me, not to regurgitate stories that have been told by, you know, so many others before. I just, I really find that to be an important aspect of storytelling for myself, for the people that are investing in the books and the stories and the time. I don't want to waste their time with something that they've heard 1,000 times before, looking for a unique something in these series.
Well, they definitely are that. Yeah, I know the reviews have been almost all extremely, extremely positive. I know the Book of Sariel's planned. I know we have that on our list to come out probably this summer. And we're seeing that as a fifth book of Thanatology.
Yeah.
I think what we'll do is have you back on to talk about that closer to the time
okay.
that gets released. You have another book out there, Among the People, that
yes.
sort of ties to Thanatology.
It does, and it's, you know, I think that's right now that's the story that I just had somebody pick it up and read it, and they asked me if I was doing a follow-up to it, and I said the interesting thing is the Book of Sariel ties Among the People into the Thanatology series, Among the People into the Thanatology series. And the unique thing about Among the People is it deals with truly a supernatural aspect. And it is the high level over, you know, looking out at this story is it's about an angel that falls from the grace of God and he's inside hell. Well, he discovers something so shocking about the workings and the mechanics of hell, and he's one of the hierarchy fallen angels inside, and he finds out what hell is really up to, and it frightens him and disgusts him so much that he tries to escape. But it's said when I was writing this book and I was doing a little investigations about angels and learning and so on and so forth, it said that once an angel falls from the grace of God, he could never return. So the struggle of the story is that he discovers something so appalling, he needs to alert heaven. But he's not allowed to return. So what he does is he hides himself among the people. And that's hence the title, Among the People, is now he's trying to bide time. But what ended up happening is now he hides among the people, while the people that are around him start to suffer because of him. And it becomes a supernatural struggle on our plane of existence. Very interesting, very unique. And again, the Book of Sariel really latches onto that one pretty hard and pulls it in. I tie it in pretty well to the series where, you know, this universe is really getting big, and soon we're going to probably have to make some sort of reference book because there's so much to it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So that's 6 pretty intense psycho thrillers. And I guess we'll tie that Among the People into the overall series.
Yeah.
Now you had a couple other books that are quite a bit different.
Yes.
You did 2 supernatural thrillers, more along the lines of like your traditional monster horror thriller type novels, the White River Monster, the Ice Canyon Monster, though these do have interesting twists to them as well. Why don't you give us a couple minutes on each of those?
Okay. I got to tell you, I find these 2 books to be just so much fun. I had so much fun writing them. You know, as I was alluding to earlier, as we were talking about the Thanatology series, I really pour my heart and soul into it. You know, and it really takes a lot of yourself to do a story such as those. So I wanted to do something that wasn't so complex. I didn't want to do something that, you know, where I was tying this knot that was just so complex that I was just trying to really challenge the reader. You know, that's really my purpose, is to challenge the reader, challenge the reader's imagination, see if they can figure out what's going on, take them along this journey. So I decided to do the White River Monster because it's out of Newport, Arkansas, that, you know, everybody thinks that they've seen what this White River Monster looks like. So what I did was I created a White River Monster and created a whole bunch of characters, and it's just a whole lot of monster fun. It's actually intelligent. I still consider it to be intelligent fiction. It's not by any stretch of the imagination, it's just blood, guts, and gore, although there are some killings in there from a monster and stuff, so that's to be expected in a monster book. But they actually have a motive of why they're doing the things that they're doing and what their existence is all about. Their existence isn't just to kill somebody that comes upon their territory. It's much more than that. Real fun. I think it's a great story, and I know that people that read it, they really, really like it. And the Ice Canyon Monster, very much of the same. It takes place in Greenland, and it deals with shaman and Greenlandic culture. So I had to study on that, and I had a real, real good time with that. And for those of people that don't know what a Tupolac is, well, it's made of bone and like sinew and stuff like that, and they tie it together and they put a spell on it, and they believe in their culture that this thing can actually make something. And this is how it makes the Ice Canyon Monster. And it has a plight, and the plight is really interesting, and the facts that I pull out for the story, I tie it into fiction, and it's a very satisfying story. It's a quicker read than the other books, but it's again, it's real unique in my opinion. It's very action packed, and it's mixed up with facts too.
And I think what triggered that was there was a period where we were looking at what was called climate fiction, a new category, mm-hmm. cli-fi, and I know we were looking at some ideas just to test it out. So the premise yeah. here is the ice is melting and something gets unleashed. And
yes.
Who knows what's up there in those polar ice caps?
Absolutely. And you know, and again, this isn't a preachy book by any stretch of the imagination. So, you know, it's not like a cli-fi, oh my God, the world is melting, I need to run out and, you know, whatever.
Yeah, tax my carbon. Yeah,
exactly. But it really does. It brings in facts about the shipping lanes and, you know, how much emissions these big, huge, enormous boats put out, these cargo ships, and what it's doing to the people of Greenland, the island of Greenland. I mean, it's really interesting. A lot of people look at it and they think it's a country. It's actually not. It's an island. It's a huge island. It's very beautiful, and the things that I learned about it, and just amazing. It's really an amazing thing, and it was a great learning experience, and it's something for it's great for monster fans. It's great for people that are into cli-fi. It's even great for people that are skeptics like myself, who wrote it as a skeptic. But you know, it changed my point of view on some things. But I really like the story. I think it's really a fun read.
Yeah, I love that cover with that sea creature on it.
Yeah, I don't know who made that cover.
Yeah. I don't know. Someone named Lawrence.
So it is a nice cover, yeah. though. It is definitely a nice track.
There's, yeah, I guess we'll jump to the Devil Tree 1 and 2, a couple books that are a little closer to home.
Not a Devil Tree.
And
yeah.
Quite a bit of at least based on a true story element to it. Maybe you could give us sort of a lowdown on that.
All right, so there's this tree in Port St. Lucie, Florida, which is on the east coast of Florida, almost like when you look at the lake, when you look at the map, you see the Lake Okeechobee in the middle of Florida, which is a little down and off to the right of that. The tree actually really stands to this day, and it's called the Devil Tree because there was a serial killer named Gerard John Schaefer that ran around here in the 1970s. And he took people, he, for some reason, had a fixation on trees. And he took people and he would take them to this tree and he would just absolutely torment them and do unspeakable acts to them And he was a really mean, ruthless serial killer. So what I did was I decided to take, again, fact and intertwine it into fiction. So it is fact and fiction. And what I did is I take the story from the 70s and I yank it into nowadays. And this guy has got one heck of an appetite for killing. And I think that we probably should tell, you know, Lawrence about the experience that I had with wrestling with a moment in a story when I'm writing it and I'm calling up my publisher.
Oh, yeah.
I'm telling my... I'm telling Lawrence here that, you know, I can't do this necrophiliac scene because it's just I don't know how to do it. And what was it that you said to me?
Well, I was very concerned that it needed to be in. I mean, it's horrific, and it's an element of what Schaefer was up to, and I thought, oh my gosh, you can't take that out. But it's just so horrendous. And I was trying to think, how on earth would you write this? And the only guidance I could think to give you was do it tastefully.
Yeah. And I remember getting, yeah, you know, and again, it's not to minimize how horrible, you know, what this guy did was. But that was actually a real learning point for me as a writer, you know. And at this point, I had, I don't know, probably 7 or 8 novels underneath my belt, you know, and I'm calling you up and I'm saying, hey, you know, I'm kind of stuck here, you know. And then when you said to me, I really remember how it struck a chord with me because you said, do it tastefully. And then I think I kind of laughed. We got a chuckle out of it. And then you said, well, wait a second. And then do you remember what you said to me? How you presented it to me?
You
said to me,
I'm going to
remind you.
Okay.
Yeah, but well, what you said to me was Hannibal Lecter, remember? He eats brains. Yeah, you said Hannibal Lecter eats brains, but people were like, ooh, but they weren't like overly, ooh, you know? So it's like you got to find that right there. You got to find the way that was done, you know,
yeah.
And that's what you meant by doing it tastefully, you know, and it's not, again, it's not minimizing how disgusting and how vile and what it is that this guy did. It's just, it made it for an interesting learning curve on how you could actually look at things differently and present it to people. So that way that they can get the full scope of what this killer was actually like.
Yeah. A way to describe it is described, but without being graphic, you kind of let everybody know what had happened.
Yes, and I remember writing it, and I sent it to you, and I said, Lawrence, what do you think? You're like, yeah, that's it. That's it right there.
Yeah,
I remember that.
Really work.
So,
yeah.
I actually hand-wrote
that. That was one of the most unusual moments.
Yeah,
pretty unusual moment, being the editor, to have to deal with that kind of a situation.
Yeah, no. No doubt, you know, and awkward as a writer to try and capture something so, you know, grotesque, and again, trying to do it in a manner that it's not overly descriptive and overly grotesque. I mean, you know, you get the idea from what happens in the book. But it was really, you know, it's just really interesting, and I also wanted to mention that because just to give people an idea of what goes on behind the scenes actually as you're creating, you know, these stories and these works to come out, you know, the questions and the, I don't even know if the struggles are right, but the indecision and, you know, what do I put in? What do I not put in? Because again, having it based off of a real killer that, by the way, a profiler said that this guy was one of the nastiest serial killers to ever walk the face of the earth, and hardly anybody has even heard of him. So to read the story is to understand the full shock and awe of how, first of all, I don't want us to give away what he did and who he was, but just to understand what he was in life and the things that he did. But I will say that he is known or believed to have killed more than 35 people, and he was only convicted on 2. He was convicted on 2, and then they left the rest. And to me, when I was investigating this, I had been very troubled by that. And the reason being is because I was like, what about the closure of the other victims that they tied him to? It was like there was no closure. They just had these two, and it was enough to put them away for life. So they just said conviction and done, and they just kind of left it at that. And this guy was a master manipulator. I mean, he was even a master manipulator inside the prison when he was inside serving his sentence in the prison, which he was never getting out for. He was serving life. But he would do some just bizarre things. He would send letters. You got to remember, this is back in the 70s, so it's not like with today's technology. He would send letters to other inmates acting like he was a woman, that he was interested in them. And he would just get off on this stuff. He was just really weird. He was just a very bizarre guy.
Now, there's more to this story than just the Schaefer character.
Yes.
I mean, you've built a supernatural element to it, plus the name,
yes,
the Devil Tree. What can you tell us about the Devil Tree itself that you can share without giving too much away?
Are you talking about, like, the characteristics? Are you talking about what it's like to actually see the Devil Tree?
Yeah, maybe
that what you're looking for?
The reality of the Devil Tree would be a good angle to come at it, because I know
I've been at the Devil Tree countless times, and it's absolutely a beautiful tree. It's stunning. You know, it's enormous. I mean, people don't get the scope of the size of this tree until you're in front of this thing. I mean, I have pictures in the back of both, in the print copies, of course, not on the Kindle versions, but in the print copies, we have pictures of the tree. And then in the Devil Tree 2, we have a picture of myself standing next to the tree. And I look like this little, you know, stick. I'm not a very big man to begin with, but, you know, I look like this little thing next to this big, giant tree. And it bears all of the markings of what the legend says, you know, that they've, I'll give like one thing, that they've tried to cut it down, and you see that they've tried to cut it down, or at least attempted to, and the tree thwarted the blows. So it's believed that the area is, that the tree is cursed, and not only is the tree cursed, so is the area. And there's also ruins deep in the, you know, because it's in a foresty area, although it's in a neighborhood. It's on a preserve area, and inside the foresty area, because this tree sits on the tip of a path, and behind it is ruins. In the ruins, it's believed that Schaefer would take people into the ruins, because the walls back then were higher than they are now. Just really, it's when you're in there, you're really drawn back into the earlier times of when all of this stuff was up, and, you know, what this guy was up to, and maybe what this area was like, you know, back in the 1970s, on how, you know, just now the trees have overtaken everything, and, you know, everything is in, it's crumbling, and it's just really the whole area. I've had a couple of bizarre incidents. I don't want to get too far into that, but I've had a couple of bizarre things happen to me while I was there. One of them revolved around an owl, and didn't make sense. And the person that I was with at the time while I was investigating the tree was absolutely freaking out, and I was trying to figure out what was going on. And to this day, I still can't make sense of it. So I've had some experiences there. I've gone with a woman that was a psychic, and I spent some time with her. Her and I spent, I think, about an hour to an hour and a half there, and it was just real interesting, and the feedback that she was giving me. And I was warned by many people to stay away from the tree, which is what the Devil Tree 2 book is about, the continuation of, you know, Schaefer is no longer on this earth. And it's about the people now that feel that they have some sort of own the tree, that they feel like that is their area. And these people are into dark arts and things like that. You know, and I've had some people threaten me, stay away from my tree, so on and so forth. You know, I just take that with a grain of salt, and I keep doing the things that I do. So the ending of The Devil Tree 2 is really, to me, if people pay attention to the ending of that particular story, it tells you the premise of the possible third and final book in the series about the real mystique behind the tree and the great lengths that people have gone to. It's really, really an interesting thing. And I found this out from somebody that is into the dark arts. So it's just very interesting.
Interesting. I think there's probably a book in a more of a nonfiction view of the Devil Tree and its legends and lore, if that hasn't already
been
done. Maybe we don't want to get too close to this one.
I had started writing it. I entitled it Under the Devil Tree, dealing with my experiences and then taking out any of the fiction that's in it. And one of these days I'm going to get back to it. But as you know, right now we have Southside Sirens coming out. We have Book of Sariel. We have the Devil Tree. We're working on the Devil Tree graphic novel.
Right.
So that's exciting. I mean, I can't wait to even just reveal the cover that Klaus did. I mean, Wolfgang is dead. And it's spectacular. It's beautiful. So it's I'm looking forward to this graphic novel of the Devil Tree getting done. I think we should probably see it by beginning of next year. It takes a long time to draw 250 pages and letter them and do all of that. On top of writing other novels and such. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Now, before we leave the Devil Tree, I just wanted to mention you had told a story about a police officer that you had met in Port St. Lucie and his take on the Devil Tree.
Yeah. Yeah. Was that the owl story that I told you?
I don't know if it was the owl story or if you had just run into a police officer who had a supernatural experience.
I'll tell the owl story. It was really interesting because I was at a Comic-Con and I was, I had a table at one of the Comic-Cons and I was over in Port St. Lucie and I was meeting and greeting people, signing books and such. And Port St. Lucie police officers were in charge of security there. And when there was some break in the actions, I had this officer that came over to me, and he was really uncomfortable looking at me, shifting from foot to foot. And he's kind of like, I got something to tell you, don't think that I'm, weird or anything or whatever, what is it? And, he's kind of twisting a little bit in his stance. And he finally looks at me and he's like, listen, I had an experience with Devil Tree I need to tell you about. And I'm like, all right. So it's during the day. He gets a call that there's a disturbance inside Okhamic Park, which is where the Devil Tree is located. So he, they don't like going in there, to tell you the truth. That's the consensus that I get, at least. And the moral of the story is that this man, he was of Latino descent, and I didn't know at the time. So this ties into that owl story that I started telling, like I had an experience. But he and my experience came after his, and it came months after his. So I didn't even tie two and two together until this was all over. But anyhow, this guy, he radios in, he gets out of the police vehicle, and he goes to go to the Devil Tree, and he hears an owl. And I find out that these guys kind of mess with each other. They're like anybody else at work. They like to have fun and, tease each other and do all sorts of silly things, turn on each other's windshield wipers and the brights and stuff. So when they start their car to start their shift, everything is going and the windshield wipers are going, you got me, let's get on with the day. And he thought somebody was messing with him. And he was hearing this owl flying. And again, owls are nocturnal. According to his cultured beliefs, that if you see an owl during the day, it's a bad omen. Well, the moral of the story is he made it to the Devil Tree, cleared it. He was at the Devil Tree. He said the hair was standing up on the back of his neck. He was really uncomfortable. He really had to get out of there. He needed to get out of there now. He goes, I am not trained to run away. I am not trained to just leave because I don't feel comfortable. He says, I was really uncomfortable, and I hurried out of there. He says, and I'm hearing this owl. He says, I eventually make it back to the cruiser. He could never see it. He wasn't able to see the owl. He could just hear it. And it kept hooting at him, and he can hear wings, and he said it was just bizarre. Well, he gets back to his cruiser. He gets in there, and he's like, you know, he's nervous. He's sweating. It's very hot here in Florida, obviously. I mean, not right now with the things that happened up north, but normally it's extremely hot here, and these guys are wearing vests and such. So he gets into the car. He's, you know, he says he's sweating. He's short of breath. He's, you know, panting a little bit because he hurried himself out of there. And he called up his mother. He goes, yes, I called up my mother. He goes, and I said, Mom, I went to the devil tree, and I was seeing, you know, I was seeing or hearing an owl. He didn't see it. So he was like, there was an owl following me. And I just, and the mother was like, oh, you need to do Hail Marys, or you need to do, he said, so I prayed, you know, the guy was like, I prayed so hard for so long, and I got myself out of there. And he goes, and I'm telling you, I can't explain what happened to me that day. So moral of the story is I took a friend to the tree, and this is what I was explaining before, and it started becoming dusk. My experience was at dusk, and I had somebody else with me, so I had somebody witness to it. And I didn't tell the person about this experience, but I had an owl hooting at me, and I was hooting back at it, and the thing was answering me. And my curiosity is not to run away. My curiosity is to go towards what I'm hearing, because I want to have an explanation for what I'm experiencing. And unfortunately, I was not able to fulfill that investigation because the person that I was with was frightened and wanted me to get them out of there. And I did. And this went on for a period of time. So this wasn't like a minute or two. This went on for a little while. And I was turned around, and I've been in there. Like I said, I've been inside that area so many times. And for me to get turned around and couldn't find my way out, it was just weird. It was very weird for me. Very weird experience.
Well, that's the opening scene to the movie, is this owl up in the tree looking down at what's going on. I can just see it. That would be cool. Hopefully,
yeah, it would be.
Hopefully you can find someone who will ultimately film that.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I was going to say we got about 10 minutes to go, and I definitely want to cover the new book that's coming out, so we'll dedicate the rest of the show to that, the Cultures Collide series. So you had You Killed My Brother, and then it's sequel coming out, Southside Sinners. So maybe you could tie those two together and tell us what you're up to with Southside Sinners.
All right. Well, let me start with with You Killed My Brother. Crime, it's my shot at crime. I kind of don't stay in one particular genre. I wanted to challenge myself and write something a little bit different. And out came The Baby Called You Killed My Brother. And it deals with a ruthless street gang. And it deals with a ruthless street gang at war with a very wealthy and well-respected family in a community. I don't specifically say what location that this takes place out of, because I want the reader to kind of pull it into maybe a place that they might be familiar with. So I never say specifically where exactly that this takes place, but it's fun. It's told from two different points of views. It's told from the side of the gang, and it's also told from the side of the rich family. It's mayhem. It's crime. It's a little bit of chaos, and it's a real fun book. Again, it was another book that I had a lot of fun writing, and I've always had requests for writing a second one, and I had intended writing the second one, but, you know, along came The Devil Tree, along came some of the other Thanatology titles, so I did eventually finish three years later, I believe. I ended up finishing the second follow-up book to it, which you had already said is called Southside Sinners. Well, the Southside Sinners is actually the name of the gang in You Killed My Brother. So it is the rise of the second book is the rise of the Southside Sinners. And not to give away too much about the story, again, it's the same sort of idea about a family, you know, how these two families are intertwined. One is into dealings of no good, and the other family comes from a family of doctors and police officers and higher education and stuff like that. But the real interesting part of the book is just how fate keeps bringing these people together. And it's not just like this. I don't just throw this Hail Mary. It's kind of cool how I make fate tie into how all of these events unfold. So, you know, through the first book and then the second book, which takes place some 20 years later. So then I have to backfill on what has happened since, because although relevant, it closes off the first book and introduces the second Southside Sinners and the new family members that are arising, you know, that are rising because now the people from the first book are a bit older, or they've moved on, or what have you. So I felt like doing something completely different rather than just rolling right into, you know, hey, this is what happened 6 months later, or this is what happened a year later when somebody got out of prison. No, I just wanted to do something completely different, and I wanted to push it 20 years forward and see how I could paint this picture. And I had a lot of fun doing this. A lot of fun.
I saw you had a little fun on social media while you were writing it. Weren't you asking for character names and such?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So what I did was I really like to ask people and any of my readers that want a name in a book or something, for the most part, if I haven't used the name or something very similar to it and I think it's a cool name, I'll use it. So that's what I did with this, is I used a whole bunch of different names of people that wanted their names to be in the book. And then I've had other people where I've combined their name, maybe a first name from somebody and a last name from somebody else. And I just, I had fun with it, you know, and I just think that you can see it in the story as you're reading it. It's meant to be a fast-paced crime story that's, you know, it has violence in it, but that's what would happen if you came across a ruthless street gang. So, you know, I can't have them playing checkers and chess. That wouldn't make for much fun in a crime book. So, real fun writing it. Real fun.
So,
and I love the cover.
The
cover is beautiful.
A reader should definitely check in on "You Killed My Brother" first, and then
I would recommend it absolutely. Yeah, because I think that "You Killed My Brother" is a really, really good story. You know, and I think it just gets better. I actually think that the second book is better. So I think that it's getting better. You know, now, of course, I've already planned on a third book in the series, and it's called The Empire Kings. I already have a title for it. It's called The Empire Kings, and it's, again, it's going to be a launch off of the second book, and it's going to take place maybe some years later, maybe not 20 years later, but it's going to take place some years later because of the devastation that's left at the wake of the first book. And then again, at the end of the second book, you know, there needs to be some time for other things to develop, and a lot of fun writing it. And like I said, the cover on that is absolutely dynamite. I think the cover on that book, both the first cover and the second cover is really cool. It's intriguing. I remember when you showed me the cover to the first book, I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, it's a little dark and it captures the mood. So I really like that. I like the cover that tells the story too.
We've got just a few minutes to go, and just to kind of recap, you got a lot on your plate. You have Southside Sinners coming out here sometime in March, probably towards the end of the month. And the graphic novel for The Devil Tree, you think maybe we're many months away on that because the artwork has to be done.
Yeah.
The Book of Sariel is probably slated for the summer, as we said. What? Anything else on your plate? Anything else?
Yes, I have. I have another book, and this one's really. When I said that the Lurking Man is really close to my heart, I'm writing a new one now, and it's called The Weight of the Soul, And the cover that you did, Lawrence, was absolutely fantastic with that. This story is probably going to be very much in the lines of The Lurking Man. It's very, very emotional, and it's based off of something that I need to write about and to get out there. And The Weight of the Soul is my father passed on 8 years ago, and it's about my father. So it's going to be really good. He meets Sariel. So it's when my pop meets Sariel and what my dad is doing in the afterlife and how he's transitioning from the living into the afterworld. And when he comes across Sariel, and he comes across many other intriguing characters, as, you know, as of course in the Thanatology series, there's so many other characters that I didn't even mention. And, you know, almost every name in the book means something. So if there's a weird name to a character, somebody should actually Google it and look it up, because it actually means something. It holds a greater meaning than just an unordinary name.
Right.
So everything in that series has great, great meaning. So yeah, so Weight of the Soul, and that'll probably be the end of 2018, if not beginning of 2019.
Cool. Very cool. So real quick, last question. You got about a minute. If I'm a new reader and I want to pick up a Keith Rummel book, where should I start? What would you recommend as sort of a first read?
That's so hard, but I have to answer the question. So I'm going to say three different spots. You start at, of course, the classic, The Cursed Man. Of course, you could start at The Lurking Man, which I love that story too. Or you could, if you want to do serial killer sort of thing, certainly The Devil Tree is it's really a great story. So I would say those three stories are really awesome. But, you know, I mean, picking your favorite out of the 13 now, it's hard, because each one is a different chapter in your life as you're telling these stories and stuff. So I'm close to them all, but yeah, start there, or try one of the Monsters books if you're into,
you know,
say Cthulhu or something.
I would just say buy all three. Get started with that. Well, listen,
yeah,
Keith, it was
absolutely.
Great to have you on. It's great to
Thank
have you.
You
on. Thank you for joining us. Hope to have you back.
Thank you. You will. Absolutely. Appreciate the time.